Welcome to the University of Wisconsin Foundation, Bascom Hill Society Showcase Series podcast, featuring some of the University of Wisconsin's best and brightest faculty and staff. This installment features David Cannon, University of Wisconsin-Madison political science professor and expert in American political institutions, and Virginia Shapiro, the Sylvan Nisba P. Breckenridge Professor for Political Science and Women's Studies, and Associate Vice Chancellor for Teaching and Learning.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Keene. I'm with the UW Foundation. I work with Political Science Department. Thank you for coming today, and thank you for your continued support of the university and membership in the Bascom Hill Society. We're very fortunate today to be able to hear from a couple very distinguished political scientists to share with us their thoughts on what happened in the elections last week, and to generate a little bit of a discussion here and questions about what happened. So without further ado, let me introduce to you Graham Wilson, the chair of the Political Science Department, who will introduce our two featured speakers this afternoon. Graham?
Thank you, Steve. It's always a great pleasure and honor to meet with the Bascom Hill Society. I think that the history of the university in recent times has reminded us that, as Richard Nixon used to say, now more than ever, we need good friends, and you are people who have been great friends of the university. I see in the audience a number of people who have been great friends not only of the university, but of our department in particular, and of course I'm extremely grateful to them for their continuing friendship and support. It really does make a tremendous difference in the effective operation of a department like ours and the opportunities that we can provide to both faculty and students. So thank you for your continuing friendship and support. We love to have the opportunity to bring to Bascom Hill some of our faculty and let you hear them, let you see them. And today you have two speakers who will be familiar to you. Virginia Shapiro's many services to the university as well as the department are well known, including her time as interim provost, as an associate vice chancellor for teaching and learning, and in chairing three departments. But in spite of her extreme youth, Gina has spent a long time following public opinion and elections from her early days, not so long ago, as a graduate student in, dare I say, at Michigan, through the time when she was director of the American National Election Studies, the authoritative academic source of information on voting behavior in this country. And so Gina will be somebody who has a great perspective on political change to share with you today. David Cannon, my colleague, is somebody whom I love to take out to alumni events around the country to show what our department is really about. He, of course, has a tremendously distinguished research career, studying Senate originally, moving on from that to study, most appropriately for today, that contested topic of redistricting, and so he has a great deal of background to share with you on that. But when David is not doing events like this or doing great research, you can often find him teaching 104, Introduction to American Government, and doing so with great effect and with great popularity with the students. And so I always like to tell the alumni, as I tell you today, that I think what our department is all about is that combination of great research and great teaching, and David very much embodies that tradition of the department. They have decided, having looked around the room, and noticed a few people who seem to have some political experience, I see quite a few myself, that rather than give a long lecture to you, what they're going to do is to talk about 10 questions that they've identified, 10 questions to do with things that are of interest and importance about the elections last Tuesday, and then, noting the eminence and knowledge of the audience, they are going to hope to draw you into the discussion. They are going to sit down here rather than standing up here in duo. And now over to you, David and Gina.
Is the mic on? It's working good. We need to stand a little apart because we both have lavalier mics and we want to make sure that we don't make bad music together. So thank you, and thank you for the compliments. I'll see you after lunch, and you'll get your reward. So as Graham said, what we decided to do was to share with you 10 questions about the 2006 elections that we thought were interesting. We'll give a couple of notes about what our responses are, and then when we're through running through them, we hope we have some good discussion here. We'd like to hear what questions you found interesting or what perspectives on these questions you have. So I have the first question. Why did the Democrats win both houses of Congress and do very well in state races across the country? There are a few things there. First of all, this is a second midterm election, and we would normally expect during a second midterm election for a two-term president that things might not go quite so well for the president. And we know in this case that that was bolstered by the fact that this was a referendum on the president and on Iraq. The Republicans, of course, had more seats to lose, so that would be one help. The Republican Congress, as assessed by the public, hadn't really done very much, certainly hadn't accomplished what it claimed it would do, and in this case, clearly politics had become much more seamy and rife with scandal and corruption and hypocrisy, and that's really basically kind of quotation from public opinion that they didn't look so good. Let me share a little bit. The districts where the shift to the Democrats in Congress took place were very particular kind of places that had been more Republican and moved this time. Wealthy suburban districts showed more switch from Republican to Democratic Congress members than did other places. But in terms of the vote, the greatest shifts toward the Democrats happened among poorer people rather than more wealthy, and the suburban and the rural rather than the urban. So there were clearly some particular issues people were looking at. What were those issues? Well, the things the people most cared about in this election and said were the basis of their votes. First and foremost, the economy. The economy, which is the usual answer. That's very typical of the electorate, 82%. But then we move to scandal and corruption, terrorism, Iraq, immigration. All of those kind of questions played very heavily, as you'd expect. If you look just at people who thought the country's on the wrong track, which is very important for looking at turnaround, among those, if people said, well, why are we on the wrong track? The biggest reasons were Iraq, as a lot of you said, then the economy and Bush and corruption. So those are our notes there. A second question, were there any real surprises in Wisconsin? And how do we explain the results here? Wisconsin, of course, pretty much followed the trends in being a good year for Democrats, a bad year for gay marriage, a good year or bad year for death, depending on how you look at it. All of these things came out pretty much as we expected in the popular vote. Nobody thought, really, that Wisconsin would defeat the gay marriage referendum. Nobody thought that the state would come out against the death penalty. The governor's race, of course, was a little bit was expected to be closer than it was in the end. The one surprise in an individual race is that most of the expectations were that Faulk would win the AG's office. That's still under contest, but that ended up being a surprise if you look at the polls. Guard was pretty much expected to win the 8th district, and of course he didn't. The state Senate change was not really expected. The Republican majority in the assembly, indeed, was reduced. What happened here? Well, we think there's probably a combination of things. One is the same kind of forces that we saw happen nationally happened here. And then if you look at the individual races, there were some key races where there were some pretty weak characters if you look at public opinion and the press and so forth. Among those who lost their seats, Dave Zien, Steve Freese, and almost Dale Schultz. And Dale Schultz, of course, is stepping back from the leadership. So some modest surprises here.
So yeah, I had to have the mute button on, then it works. That's good. It's a little backwards wiring here. Okay, so the other point about money in congressional elections I want to mention then, a trend that started about 20 years ago, and that is the increasing importance of outside money. That it's not only the candidates spending a lot of money, but it's the political parties, it's the outside groups spending money as well. And party money was very important in this election for both helping challengers, but also for the Republican Party to hold off some of the challengers. In the average competitive election, parties were pumping in about $2 million per race for the most competitive elections. And so that, again, helped some Republicans survive who otherwise wouldn't have, and also then helped a lot of Democratic challengers win. The fourth question is another question that got a lot of attention in the 2006 elections, and that is the role of technology. What's the role of technology and the technique more broadly of electing, just how we physically would vote for people? What role did that play in the 2006 elections? We heard a lot about the fact that roughly a third of American voters were using a new kind of voting technology on Tuesday. That's a huge proportion of the electorate moving to a new mechanism for voting, whether it be electronic voting or the optical scan like we use here in Madison, but a third of the voters using new technology. With those kinds of numbers, there were forecasts some people were making of just a disaster on Tuesday. They were saying it was going to be, you know, election meltdown. You'd have, you know, nothing was going to work and you'd have chaos and it was just going to be a disaster. Well, thank goodness those forecasts did not come true. That we certainly had problems around the country. Common Cause set up a 800 number hotline that they had for the entire nation to field calls from people who were having trouble voting, and roughly 16,000 people called in from around the country with various problems, but no systematic, huge, you know, systemic kind of meltdown like some people were forecasting. There were some interesting anecdotes from around the country of isolated problems. There was one poor gentleman in Pennsylvania who became so frustrated with his electronic voting machine, he took a paperweight and smashed the screen of the electronic voting machine and was arrested, and I don't know if he's going to actually serve any jail time, but for destroying federal property. Not necessarily the way you want to take out your frustrations on the voting process. And then even perhaps more humorous, you may have read about the voter ID laws that were put in place in several states. Well, in two instances, high elected officials, the governor of South Carolina and a House member from Ohio, came to the polls to vote, and they were turned away because they didn't have proper identification. So the governor and a House member weren't allowed to vote because they didn't have proper ID. So I think they may rethink their stance on voter ID, having gone through that humiliation of not being able to vote. On a more serious point in terms of voter technology, we came this close to having a real problem in Montana. That if anyone was up past midnight on Tuesday night, you may have seen that the Billings, Montana, and that county ended up moving their sort of votes from the counted column to the not counted column, because in the middle of counting the ballots, they realized that they had a problem with the technology where they were double counting all of the absentees in many of the precincts. And what had happened, they had the new technology for that city, and they were supposed to do the absentees first, scan them through. They used the optical scan machines, put them through the scanner, and then after they were done counting the absentees, they were supposed to hit a button to zero out the totals. And then they would put in the regular votes and have them counted. Well, they forgot to zero out the totals. And so what was happening is that they started counting the regular ballots again, and they were double counting all the absentees then because they hadn't zeroed out the machine. And about an hour into this process of counting the precincts, the head official recognized that something was wrong, because all of the machines were showing that every precinct had been counted, but in fact, they'd only counted about 10% of them. So he knew that something was wrong, but he didn't know what it was. And so they stopped the whole process and said, okay, we're going to start over. They called the election officials who actually, you know, made the machines. I mean, the people who manufactured the machines got some technicians there to figure out what was going on. And so at about 1 in the morning, they started the whole process over again. And the interesting quote I heard from this anecdote was the election official in Billings said that the stunning thing to him was how many lawyers descended on that place at 1 in the morning. They had like 80 people come in because they heard it was going to be a recount. At that point, everyone knew Montana was critical for whether or not the Senate would go to Democrats or Republicans. And so all these lawyers from both sides were there, you know, standing, watching like hawks for every move what they were doing with the recount, but they got it right. They did, you know, they got everything recounted and they did it right. But that shows how close you could come to having a complete error that, you know, may have tipped the actual balance of the Senate. So we do put a lot of faith in our voting technology, but it also ultimately often comes down to, you know, one election official seeing that something was wrong and doing something to fix it.
Note to self, wear deeper pockets next time. Question five is, what was the role of social groups and divisions on the vote in the House? Things like religion, gender, race, urban-rural divisions, and education. And this is always interesting to look at to try to figure out what's really going down at the grassroots and how different portions of the population are shifting across the parties. So let me just give you a little review of some of those major categories. First, age. This is important because it begins to tell us a little bit about the future. The youngest cohort was definitely the most Democratic. About, if you take the youngest, you know, decade of voting, they were about 61% Democratic, and every other age group was less Democratic. For those of us who are interested in where people get their political attitudes and ideas, this is very important because this is the Clinton generation, the first group of voters who grew up during the Clinton period. So we're beginning to see the somewhat more conservative cohort, those who were children growing up in the Reagan era, who are now becoming more middle-aged. And the youngest group is clearly the most Democratic at this point. On gender, we've gotten used to seeing the gender gap since the 1980 election, where women have been somewhat more in the Democratic base than men have in some elections, but not all. Women and men have voted for different sides. And what we saw this year was really not much difference overall. Some women were still voting slightly more Democratic than men. But of course, what was happening this year is the gap was narrowed because the men were changing their minds. So depending on which side you're on, the men were getting smarter or dumber. I'll leave that to you. But the women increased their Democratic vote to some degree, but the men clearly were increasing their Democratic vote. This was especially true among the least educated, that is, those people without a high school education. If we look at that group, we see a big gender gap. 70% of the least educated women and 57% of the least educated men voted Democratic. And we would imagine a lot of that has to do with stands on social issues and other sorts of things that would divide the men and women among the least educated group. So let's turn to education itself. And here you see a usual kind of spread, maybe a little more exaggerated. Among the least educated group, those without high school, about 64% voted Democratic in the House elections. Up to college grads, about 50%. So range from 64% among the least educated to 50% among college educated. And we would normally see that. By the way, if you get to the post-grads, people with masters and PhDs and MDs and so forth, and I see quite a number of those in this room, when you get to the hyper-educated folks, then you get a little bit more support of the Democrats than you do among those just with a college degree. What's that about? The liberal professions, those who run the social services, those whose life work really converge much more with the traditional Democratic social agenda. So there's a lot of things we can see in there. On race, for a long time now, we've expected to see much more support of Democrats among African Americans than among white people. We certainly see that again. The Democrats in the House races actually lost among whites. If you put all white folks together in this country, you find that 48% of them voted in House races for the Democrats, compared with 83% of people from different minority groups. So we still have a difference there, which probably still has to do with the race politics of this country, social welfare politics, a number of other things that have really divided us in partisan ways since the mid-1960s. If you look at the particular minority groups, 89% of African Americans voted for Democrats, 70% of Hispanic voters. That's a rise. We've been seeing the Hispanic voters being more Republican than that for a while, and 62% of Asian voters. So we still have some interesting differences in that regard. On religion, I think a lot of you probably saw the discussion in the news about the discontent among the evangelical leaders with the Republican Party that they've been aligned with for quite a while, especially because of issues having to do with the poor and social welfare and those kinds of questions. On moral issues, so-called moral issues, of course, the Christian right and evangelicals are still very supportive of the Republican Party, although they think that they've been sold out a bit. But on issues having to do with care of the poor and so forth, which is also a traditional part of the evangelical Christian organizations, there's been disappointment. So we saw a little bit of drawing back, but there's some interesting differences among the religious groups. Among white Protestants in this country, 38% voted for Democrats in the election. 38% among white Protestants, 45% of Protestants overall, 56% of Catholics, and 88% of Jews in this country. So some traditional differences there, but a soft spot for the Democrats still remains, especially white Protestants, especially evangelicals. In terms of geography, as we expected, the East went most strongly for the Democrats, and the South went least strongly for Democratic candidates. If we look at the continuum from rural to major urban areas, this is very important for partisan divides, because a lot of people have been claiming that the Democratic Party has been doing particularly badly in the rural and small town areas. Advocates of the Democratic Party say that the Democratic Party has actually given up where they shouldn't. They don't know how to speak to the rural areas. And so we still see that the only place where the Democrats only gained minority support is in rural areas. 49% of people in rural areas voted for the Democrats. Much more support in the cities, in the big cities, of course. And then finally, on this question of group differences is income. We have been used for a long time to seeing that the more wealthy people are, the more likely they are to vote Republican, and that has not changed in the continuum, although perhaps in degree. If you look at the poorest people in our society who actually voted, those with less than $15,000 a year incomes, 69% supported Democrats in the House. If you look at people who earned over $100,000 a year, it was 48%. So 69 to 48. By the time you get to, you know, the wealthiest quintile, those earning over $100,000, then you see less support and minority support for Democrats. People were asked whether they thought their standard of living was getting better or worse or staying the same. And we would expect a large amount of purchase on this for telling us who voted where. We know people who think things are going the wrong way like to vote against the incumbents. For those people who thought that their standard of living is getting better, 28% voted for Democrats in the House races. For those who thought that their standard of living is getting worse, 80% voted for Democrats. That goes back to that idea that top of the pops, always, no matter what else is going on in this country for elections, especially for the House, will be the economy.
Okay. Next question is, what was the turnout at the voting booth like this year? Here, there was a lot of anticipation before the election. This would be a very high turnout election. Most of the polls were showing voters following the election much more closely than they had in the past, more people showing an interest in the campaigns, more competitive races than we'd had in the past. And turnout was up a bit, but still kind of disappointing. And in fact, I think kind of an embarrassment to our country compared to most other Western democracies. The national turnout was about 36% of the voting age population. Now, for a midterm election, believe it or not, that's actually a little above average. Now, there is another way of measuring turnout that isn't voting age population, but instead voting eligible population. A political scientist named Michael McDonald recognized a few years ago that in the past few decades, we've had a growing share of our population that's comprised of two groups of people, illegal aliens who can't vote, And people who are felons and either, you know, can't vote because they're felons and out of jail, or people currently in jail, the prison population has gone up dramatically in the last few decades. And so what he discovered is that part of the apparent decline in turnout is in fact a consequence of the fact that our voting age population, now a larger share of that voting age population, can't legally vote. And so why include them in your calculation? So he takes out the people who are in prison and the felons who can't vote and also illegal aliens and finds that the turnout is about 3 to 4% higher in general once you make that correction. Even with that correction, though, turnout's around 40%. So it's still, you know, not great. Now, Wisconsin did a little better. We were just over 50% in voting age population, about 54%. For vote eligible population, which put us about fourth in one category, fifth in the other, in the nation in turnout. And we're usually towards the top of the list. In terms of explaining sort of cross-national or cross-state variation within the United States, there are two main things that explain the variation across states. One is the competitiveness of the elections at the top of the ticket. So if you have a competitive Senate race, competitive governor race, that's going to bring more people out. Or if you have a hot-button referendum issue that also is attracting a lot of money and attention, that'll bring more voters to the polls as well. And then second, and even more important, really, is the kind of voter registration laws you have. It's estimated that there's about a 10-point difference between the least restrictive states, like Wisconsin, that allow same-day registration, and the most restrictive states that would have, say, a 30-day residency requirement that you have to fulfill before you can register to vote. So people who move to the state within a month, you know, can't even vote in that state. About a 10% difference in turnout can be explained by that factor. And so that would explain why, you know, Wisconsin, in part, is towards the top of the list. Our next question has to do with the new Congress. You know, what do the new group of members of Congress look like? What are their backgrounds? What impact will it have on Congress? First of all, just a little bit about the historical background of the of how these guys got here. The competitiveness in congressional elections this year was much higher than it had been in the past. The one thing that people had talked about in the last several election cycles was not only the high incumbency election rate, which was 98-99% in a couple of elections, but also how uncompetitive the races were. Just a handful of races were decided by less than 10% of the vote in the most recent election cycles. Well, this year we had 62 races that were decided by a margin of less than 10%. That's way up from the previous election in 2004. There's only 23, so an increase from 23 to 62 of those most competitive House races. So there is more competition there was in this election. Also, in the Senate, the Republican Senate class is the third smallest in history. Just the number of Republican senators elected is the third smallest in history. The only two classes of Republican senators that was smaller was 1934, after the FDR, the midterm after the FDR landslide in 32. So the 34 midterm only had seven Republican senators. And then 1964, the Lyndon Johnson landslide also only had seven Republican senators. On Tuesday, we elected nine Republican senators. So it's the third smallest in history of popularly elected senators. Now, in terms of their backgrounds, for the people who were elected, we've got 64 new members of Congress, 10 in the Senate, 54 in the House. There are 13 women and 50 men of the new group. Three African Americans, including the first Muslim elected to Congress, received a lot of attention in the Middle East and Arab countries, made this, you know, front page news for a couple of days that the first Muslim was elected to Congress. An interest of mine in terms of research interest, I was looking at people who are elected to Congress without previous political experience, so like our own Herb Kohl, who is able to, you know, get to the Senate without having previous experience. Well, there were several interesting examples of that in this election as well. Several Iraq veterans who came back from the war in Iraq to be elected. Heath Shuler, a former NFL quarterback, he played football for 3 years for the Redskins and a couple years for the Saints, was elected to the House from North Carolina. And then, oddly, three professional musicians. I don't know if we've had professional musicians elected to Congress before, but three of them, including one that some of you may remember back from the
19... Sonny Bono.
Well, that's right. Sonny, can you count Sonny a musician? I don't know.
He's right.
I don't think, but so. Yeah. But anyway, the John Hall of the fame, the 1970s rock band Orleans, who's famous for "Still the One" and "Dance with Me." So some of you may remember John Hall from the 70s. He's in Congress now, as are two other lesser-known musicians as well. So it's just a bit of a oddity, I suppose. So.
I think, given the time, maybe we should just name our other questions and make one or two quick points. I think you have.
Okay. So, all right. So the next thing to look at then would be, you know, what difference this makes, the new Congress. What difference will it make for the agenda of the country? And here, just a couple of quick points. I think that the Democrats will be able to accomplish some things very quickly where there is agreement between the Democrats and Republicans in the Senate, and then also President Bush. So things like immigration reform, where on immigration reform, you had the Senate and Bush in agreement on a comprehensive reform, but it was the House Republicans that stood in the way. Well, now that Democrats control both the House and Senate, we should have, I think, fairly quickly some major policy implemented on immigration reform. Also, things like the minimum wage increase. There, I think the Democrats will be able to put pressure on President Bush to have the first increase in the minimum wage in 10 years. Other policies where I think you'll have some fairly quick movement is on ethics reform in Congress, lobbying reform. Again, one of the big issues that Gina pointed to early on was this culture of corruption. And Democrats were elected in part by running against that culture of corruption. And so I think there will be real pressure to move quickly on ethics reform in Congress. And indeed, Nancy Pelosi has committed to move quickly on that issue area. The big question mark, I think, or two big question marks, are Iraq and entitlement reform. I'm not at all optimistic on the latter. That is just a huge issue out there that that Congress and the President just are not willing to even talk about what to do about the long-term unfunded liabilities for Medicare and Social Security. It's just out there, and people aren't willing to grapple with this until it becomes, I think, an even more serious problem. And that, again, I don't think anything will happen in the next 2 years. Iraq, I think we will have some movement. The Baker-Hamilton Commission is supposed to come forward with their report perhaps by the end of the year. That should serve as a good bipartisan basis for some timetable to get the troops out of Iraq in a way that will hopefully leave the country on somewhat solid footing. And that, again, will be the tough issue that hopefully we'll have some progress on.
10th question is, how did the pundits, the pollsters, and the political scientists do? And the answer is, not too bad. But the thing that we got the most wrong, that all our theory and data and everything led us in the wrong direction, is in recent decades, we talk about the hold that redistricting has on House seats, and that most seats in the country have been now designed to be safe seats, and that is true, including the one we're standing in at the moment, were designed purposely to be safe, and that's why we thought it would be very difficult to tip the House. And it's clear that there are forces that can still beat the design of redistricting. Some of it is people moving around, and some of it is other forces. And we have one bonus question before we move on, just in case, because you've been good. Will we have this much fun in 2008? And the answer is, who knows? But it's just around the corner. And the preparation is beginning. There are many localities and counties and so forth that have instituted new rules that say you have to get this year's campaign posters off the streets within 30 days, or you are fined. And clearly the reason is we have to clean our lawns and clean our streets, because we're going to start putting up signs
for 2008
in just a few months. So we have a few minutes left, I think, and it's your turn. Mr. Skornica.
Could you elaborate on the whole election versus Ben Paul, particularly in Dade County? It seems strange.
Joel Skornica's question was on the race between Van Hollen and Kathleen Falk, particularly in Dane County. The couple of things that I think I've heard people mentioning and that strike me is, one, there are a lot of people who didn't forgive her for a dirty campaign early on, who are supporters of hers, but who didn't forgive her for what was pretty negative and nasty in the airwaves. And as we know, there was a tremendous amount of negative ad going back and forth. I was looking at some public opinion polls over the last couple of weeks, and at the end it really started bouncing a lot. And when it starts bouncing like that, Who knows?
Yeah, and we don't have exit polling data on the Attorney General's race. And so, you know, we have it for governor and senator for the state, but not for Attorney General. So we don't have the kind of detailed information that Gina ran through on the other, the national figures. And so we don't really have a good understanding. So it's just more kind of a gut level sense that, yeah, she didn't do as well in Dane County as she should have. And some of it could be, I think, the negative campaigning from the primary. That's probably the best guess.
Is it really true what the New York Times investigative reporter David Johnston tells us in his book, Perfectly Legal, that it's a tenth of 1% of our population, it's 1 in 1,000 of us, who he labels as super rich, that these individuals, these 1 in 1,000 individuals, fund 80% of the state and national elections.
For individual contributions, that figure sounds about right to me. But you'd also have to calculate in then all the PAC contributions and the, you know, on the for business and labor and other groups as well. Once that would be factored in, you know, then I think that would shrink as a proportion of the overall amount. On the other hand, if you take that back one level and say, well, who gives to the PACs, then again, that's likely to be probably not quite as skewed as the individual data, but also quite skewed as well. Now, this, I'd have to see when his data were from, because I think that data would definitely be true in the era of soft money for national elections, where you could give unrestricted amounts of money, you know, $1 million, whatever. Now, individuals are limited to only $4,000 per election cycle per candidate. And so as individuals giving to individual candidates, you can't actually give, you know, that much money. And so unless they were funneling money through independent contributions to PACs, my guess is that that proportion for the top 0.1% should be lower in the post-McCain-Feingold era.
A follow-up question for those of us that are grasped with this understanding and think this is a problem, but we're not super rich, we have maybe some disposable income, where could we best make contributions to change that?
Ah, that's a great question. The question was, for people who are worried about the state of campaign finance that is so skewed in the direction of the wealthy contributors, and they're interested in giving some money to change that state of affairs, you know, who would be best to contribute money to try to change basically the state of our campaign finance system? Well, there are several sort of good government interest groups out there, you know, like Common Cause, the Center for Responsive Politics, probably the two most well-known national groups that plug away day after day after day on this issue of campaign finance. Ultimately, it's going to need to come, though, I think, from the broader public, that until this catches on as a national issue that people care about, there won't be pressure on our elected politicians to change.
There are a couple of things that McCain-Feingold does. One of the things that a lot of people... what is the effect of McCain-Feingold on elections, the Electoral Reform Act, especially on this election? And I'll leave Dave to answer most of that. But one of the things that people point out is, given the structure of wealth among Democrats and Republicans, it helped Republicans more than Democrats in terms of giving.
But yeah, and that's because McCain-Feingold doubled the hard money contributions that people could make in terms of the individual limitations went from $1,000 to $2,000 per candidate per election. So, you know, $4,000 per candidate for the election cycle. And so that did help Republicans a bit more. On the other hand, I think having the, you know, banning soft money in national elections probably helped the Democrats more, because the huge contributions coming in, again, were skewed more in the Republican direction. So maybe those two things, you know, canceled out overall. I think that the net effect, though, you'd have to say, was probably not too large, because of the total amount of money still coming in is, you know, at record levels. And so it didn't do anything to stop that overall flow of money into campaigns. And my sense is the only way you ultimately will be able to change that would be to have complete public financing of all national elections. If you don't do that, there won't be any way to really cut down on the amount of money, because it just will shift and find a new way to get into the system.
The main way most of us find out about what's going on in elections, of course, is the majority of people find out through television and advertising. And as long as that has to be privately bought,
right,
then for us to learn anything, it requires money. And so if that's the case, then the taps are going to keep going.
Is it a good idea to vote like Oregon does?
The question is, is it a good idea to vote like Oregon does, which is all mail ballot?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a tough one. I guess I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, I think the advantage is that it does make it easy to vote, and my personal view is that anything we can do to get more people to vote is a good thing. On the other hand, people who have concerns about voter fraud, and this is the part or the way of voting that is more vulnerable to fraud than anything else you can imagine, because there, you could literally have people going around, buying votes the old-fashioned way, where you go, door to door, and pay people $20 to stuff their vote into an envelope and you watch them do it. Whereas in the privacy of a voting booth, you can't do that. So there are definitely pluses and minuses.
The other thing is, for deliberative democracy, there is something to be said for imagining the whole country in a situation where what we're doing is having a discussion. It's too long now. Well, I'll grant that. But we're having a discussion, and then at some point we say, the discussion is over, okay, everybody now vote, rather than having kind of dribbles going on. And so it kind of, in the end, I don't know how much difference it makes, but it's different models. There's someone way in the back over there.
Ah, okay. Yeah, so the question is on the South going Republican, and how they did in this election and what it means for the presidential campaign. Well, in this election, in the South, the Democrats did make some inroads. Heath Shuler in North Carolina, a few vulnerable Democrats hung on just barely in Georgia, picked up a few seats. Mark Foley in Florida lost his election. He was still on the ballot. He actually had to be on the ballot. So the guy who replaced him, in order to vote for him, he actually had to vote for Mark Foley, which was quite interesting. But he actually narrowly lost. It wasn't quite as close as, or it was closer than people thought it would be. So the Democrats made some gains in the South, but maybe not quite as much as they had hoped. In terms of what this means for 2008, clearly the South is still really important in presidential politics. That it's impossible for Democrats to win the presidency without at least carrying some of the South, and that's a lesson I think they learned from 2000. And their success in 92 and 96 was in part because Clinton did quite well in the South. So I think the South remains very important in presidential politics.
We had more way back there. The impact of the elections on stem cell research? It's on the agenda in Congress. Right now, the Democratic caucus has already begun meeting to try to develop its agenda, because they know that they're just going to get shot in the brain in 2008 if they don't accomplish anything. And one of the things that they've listed on there is stem cells. Clearly, depending on what goes on in the state, I think some people who were voting for Governor Doyle were making an assumption that's a vote on one side rather than the other for stem cells. I've got to tell you, I've been really surprised at how much traction this issue gets, because if we went out on the street and asked most people what stem cells are and what this research is, I think people would have very vague ideas. So I think this one will still be up to the interest, it's like this, will still be up to the interest groups, where you have on one side people making a case that we're talking about something that has to do with some diseases that we all fear, like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And so they're talking to us as individuals, things that feel tangible that they worry about. And on the other side, it's going to be people continuing to talk about baby killing and cloning and whatever else. And so I think in the end, frankly, what's going to happen is going to continue to be this war of different kind of images of what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Over here is
the poli sci department percentage of the faculty is Republican.
I don't know. We don't list our. We don't list. It's not something we, you know, we list. It has nothing to do with our job. So I don't know. I wouldn't even know how to make a guess. A lot of us get involved in politics on election time in doing this kind of thing, doing commentary, doing election night. So we've got a lot of people who are very, very active. But one of the things that's actually very interesting about being in a field like political science is we are all are citizens of somewhere. And we're all obviously intensely interested in politics. But one of the things we have to train ourselves to do from very early in our career, and this begins in graduate school, is a process of professionalization where we work on how to distance our views as private citizens from what we teach and what we do research on. I mean, you can never get rid of it entirely, but we have to work very hard at it, and it's a professional, having taught for 30 years here, it's a professional point of pride that if I ask my students what party I am, I get students thinking both ways. Mm-hmm. Now, in my private life, I'm very partisan.
Yeah. Just to follow up on that point, Graham mentioned I teach the big introduction to American politics with 500 students, and they often ask me, are you a Democrat or a Republican? And I always tell them, well, I'm not going to let you know, but if you want to ask me the last day of class, I'll tell you then. But I always make a real effort to keep it as balanced as I can. And my favorite comment was one student once who said, well, you sound a little bit more like a Democrat, but you dress more like a Republican.
The similarity is for some of you who may be in medicine, or you may be pastors, or you may be in other fields, all of us in our professions have certain kinds of things where you have to be able to do some professionalization that separates. So if a doctor collapses every time a patient dies, or if a pastor, gets too involved personally. So it's a really interesting question because it's that kind of process. Someone, yes. A Democrat or a Republican will win.
Right. that's a good answer. Actually, I've already gotten quite a few calls from the media. The computers were still hot from the election returns on Wednesday, and they were calling on Wednesday afternoon about the 2008 presidential campaign, especially with Feingold announcing on Sunday that he wasn't going to run, and the phone was just ringing off the hook about people wanting to talk about the 2008 presidential race. For me, I think it's too early to say with any certainty. I mean, everyone has their long list of 7-8 people who might run. I think it's just impossible to say at this point.
Becker?
You said that there on the agenda would be some way of resolving
right. I said I was in my category of the tougher ones to deal with, and so the one I was most pessimistic about was entitlement reform. Iraq, I think, has a better shot than that. My optimism comes from the James Baker Lee Hamilton report that's supposed to come out pretty soon. And this is a commission that President Bush set up several months ago to seriously examine all of the issues in Iraq of how we can get the troops home, but not do it in a way that will lead to civil war. And they have a lot of the top minds in American foreign policy who really don't have an invested partisan interest in this the way that, say, the Pentagon would, or Bush's advisors, or partisan Democrats in Congress. And so I think that should give us a good blueprint to work from. Now, whether or not whether or not they'll come up with a document that really is going to be able to serve that purpose remains to be seen. But I'm hopeful, given that their qualities, both James Baker and Lee Hamilton, the other people on the commission, that I think there's a good chance that they will be able to come up with some at least ideas of what we can do. I mean, having said that, it's a nearly impossible situation. I mean, I don't personally have any sort of magic ideas of how we can get the troops home without leading to a really a horrendous situation in terms of the future of Iraq. But again, I think that this commission gives us our best hope of moving forward in a bipartisan way.
Yes.
You said the
The question here was, when I give you what percentage of, you know, women are educated or whatever, where does that come from? The figures I happen to be using were from the New York Times polls, exit polls. And by the way, for those of you who are interested and want to play more, this year, the New York Times, if you go to nytimes.com, they have a wonderful interactive kind of set of figures where you can scroll on the computer to look at these different groups. So it's all exit polls. It's the best we can do. And as should be underneath your question, it's a little uncertain. But what we know is there were some big differences and some little differences. The question is, what are our theories on why the marriage ban passed in Wisconsin? It was phrased in a way that it was sure to pass. Here's frankly my personal view of it, that if you ask the question of people, do you think it should be completely illegal and people should be punished for, you know, having same-sex partners? A huge number of people would say, certainly not, it's their private business. But when it's phrased as marriage, for a lot of people, that is simply further than they're willing to go in this culture. Because marriage is a bedrock institution. It's something, and I'm not even just talking about people who would use the word sacred, which is certainly true for a lot of people and very important for a lot of people. But even if you leave aside the word sacred, it's bedrock, it's basic organization, and that's a bridge too far for a huge portion of our population. And it was designed to be that way. Remember, a lot of the thought behind that particular referendum was not necessarily to make it illegal here, because it already is, but was to try to mobilize voters to come to the polls. And so I was surprised at what happened in Arizona. I was not surprised at what happened in any other state. Well, that's what it says.
Right.
That's what it says. It's not just about same-sex couples.
Right.
So it says civil unions. And that would be right.
Yeah.
You don't have family rights, and without civil union, then you don't have quasi-family rights. And so that covers anybody. But there will be court battles.
This will be in the courts.
Yeah. And who knows where that will come up, but it'll be in the courts. There's a huge portion of the population with a vested interest in this, not talking about just gay couples, but there's a huge portion of the population that has an interest in not having this go through. It'll run and run. We have lots of stuff that made the election hot. I mean, for people who are interested in citizenship and civic participation, to get a population out and to reverse the trend in this country of having only a small minority of our population participate in elections, here's where I am willing to take a stand. It's a good thing to get people out there. One of the problems we have is people go out for, you know, these various ideological reasons because we don't have a good base of everybody participating. I bet a little of everything happened. Sure. Mine did. His did.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Republican?
Okay. Well, McCain. On the Republican side, probably John McCain, you know, Rudy Giuliani are mentioned, sort of the top of the of most people's lists. Bill Frist, the former Senate Majority Leader from Tennessee, almost certainly will run.
Someone else? Anybody else Republican?
Those are probably the three that are named most often. So Bloomberg decided not
Romney,
to run, just announced.
Mitt Romney?
Yeah, Mitt Romney's Jolson. Another one. On the Democratic side, the big question is Barack
not
Obama
Russ.
Right now.
Yeah.
That Barack Obama, you know, a lot of excitement for him nationally. He's speculating about running. Hillary Clinton, of course, is probably the front runner
Biden.
On the Democratic side. Biden, John Edwards, the all sort of names that you. Some people even say bring back Al Gore. I don't know about that, but and Kerry, I think, probably stuffed his foot in his mouth a little bit too much with that botched joke the other week. So yeah, I think his slim chances are even slimmer now.
Kerry can go be a speech writer and write the jokes.
Right.
We skipped somebody.
Or Crawford.
There was somebody who was trying
to
get in before.
Too. That's a great question.
Yeah. I can't imagine. The question is, will the shift in the Hispanic vote change the immigration debate and especially silence some of the side that has been very anti-immigration? Nothing's going to silence any part of this. This is really one of those crucial issues, especially, of course, the closer you go to a southern border or a water border, in other words, anything other than Canada, the more crucial this gets. And I think it'll change the debate, and of course it's a very localized debate in some areas. I think it'll make the forces kind of more even and contentious.
But I think it is an issue that's going to hurt the Republicans, though, down the road. If they, you know, stick to a strong anti, at least in certain parts of the country, it's going to hurt them. And you saw that shift. It was about a 15% shift or so towards the Hispanic voters, you know, towards Democrats in this election. So clearly, they're, you know, a growing part of the electorate. And if they vote, you know, overwhelmingly Democratic, that will, you know, definitely will hurt Republicans down the road. And it runs against, you know, President Bush's big tent strategy. I mean, Bush had made a serious effort over the last several years to reach out to Latino voters. And he, through, you know, nominations, through, you know, appointments to the court, and certainly through his immigration policy himself, he was really trying to reach out. But his colleagues in the House really torpedoed him on that. And I think that it has hurt the Republican Party.
I think we're getting the hook, so we enjoyed this, and we'll see you in 2 years.
Thank you for joining us for this installment of the Bascom Hill Society Showcase Series podcast. For more information on this and other topics, please visit the University of Wisconsin Foundation homepage at www.uwfoundation.wisc.edu.